all these high yield companies have basically been relatively smart in terming out their debt. So the moment they need to refinance comes much later in time than what we are normally used to in the cycle, but it's about to come. And I think it's something that people don't realize because it just takes time and it's a very slow and boring process. And we live in a world where we want news every day, and you know, we see the stock market going up, and then we tend to forget about how macro works and how the lag of tightening cycles really works.
Welcome to Thoughtful Money. I'm its founder and your host, Adam Taggart. Since the October lows, stocks have roared back to record highs, and bonds have risen solidly too, as U.S. 10-year Treasury yields have dropped from 5% to near 4%. Will the bull run continue through the rest of 2024? I mean, it's an election year in America after all. Or have the animal spirits carried assets to unsustainable price levels, putting us in danger of a painful sell-off? To find out, we've got the good fortune to hear from macro expert Alf Pecatiello of the Macro Compass. Alf, thanks so much for joining us today, all the way from the Netherlands.
Yes, Adam. Nice to be here with you. Always a pleasure to be on the channel.
Always a pleasure, my friend. We got a lot to talk about, including the new macro fund that you're launching. So I want to make sure we reserve time so you can explain what that's all about to folks. Yeah, a lot going on in the markets right now. You've been writing a lot about this stuff and talking about this stuff recently. So I want to dial through a lot of your recent work if we can. To kick it off though, let me just ask the intentionally general question I like to ask you at the start of our conversations. Yeah. What's your current assessment of the global economy and financial markets?
I think the global economy is slowing down, clearly so. It's taking its sweet time for the tightening in financial conditions and in interest rates to feed into the real economy more openly, but it is happening. And we are having some more signals, I think, as we speak. One of it was the latest job report from the Fed, from the BLS on Friday last week. And, you know, the job report showed that after revisions, the private sector is still adding 200,000 jobs on average a month for the last 3 months, which seems quite a decently strong number. If you look a bit under the hood, you realize the sector concentration of these jobs being added. So, you know, it's quite concentrated into the government sector, the healthcare sector in particular. And the other thing you can realize when you look at it is that if you slice away the cyclical industries, so that's the manufacturing, construction, trade, you know, this type of more cyclical driven industries, they haven't really been hiring that hard for the last year. Actually, the hiring rate of the cyclical industries, Adam, is the weakest since 2011. Mm-hmm. And on top of it, the creation of full-time jobs is now negative year on year, looking at the past 12 months. So again, yes, we are adding jobs, sure, but we are adding them only in certain sectors. The cyclical industries are hiring at a very, very slow pace, on par with 2011. And also you have a situation where full-time jobs aren't really being added. And so the quality of this job creation is something that generally shows some emerging weakness into real economic growth. Now, why is it taking so long? Because this type of weakness, we would have expected it maybe 6 or 9 months ago or 12 mm-hmm. months ago, but it is taking way longer. And this is something to recognize. And the answer there is that the US economy, I think, is better equipped than people think to handle the hit of higher interest rates for a longer period of time. And the main reasons are that American people and corporates have been pretty smart. They've locked in low interest rates for a long period of time. So when you raise interest rates, the pass-through, the cost really of these higher interest rates isn't really felt unless you need to refinance your debt. And if you have extended the maturity of your debt, then you probably don't need to do that very soon, be the corporate or be the household. And I mean, Americans have been smart terming out their debt. That means raising interest rates takes longer to feed in the weakness that you would expect. But it is now slowly starting to happen.
Okay, so the lag effect is slowly starting to arrive. Is that another way to say this?
Yes, I would say so. I think the next 6 to 9 months are going to be pretty interesting because historically, if you raise interest rates and then you keep rates over 5% for a while, like the Federal Reserve is doing, but then real GDP growth keeps being around 2, 2.5%. I think people just throw the towel in on this recession thing. You know, it's natural, Adam. Like, how long is it going to take?
Right.
And then people say, like, well, okay, something is wrong this time. You start hearing about the neutral interest rate is higher. I mean, those are key words for me to hear. They're like a signal, because I heard the same words from Powell and FOMC members in September 2018. If you remember, the Fed had raised interest rates in 2017 and in 2018, and it looked like the US economy was handling that okay. And so at some point, they thought that, you know, higher interest rates were not really restrictive for the US economy. In other words, that the US economy could handle higher interest rates more structurally, or in central bank jargon, the neutral rate is higher, okay? And then Powell said that in September 18, and guess what? In November 18, December 18, the stock market went down 20%, and we figured out that no, it wasn't different, the neutral rate wasn't higher. And now I'm starting to hear that discussion again. And is it, it's human nature, Adam, right? I mean, you raise interest rates, you're supposed to slow down the economy doesn't really slow down a lot, and it's been now quite a lot of time since the Fed has gone through with this fast hiking cycle. Rates have been above 5% for 3 or 4 quarters now, almost in a row. And then people just say, well, this time is different, the neutral rate is higher. When you start getting towards these discussions, funnily enough, as in 2007 or in 2018, you tend to be closer to the part of the cycle where it's more likely that weakness will show up.
Yeah, all right, great. Yeah, it's the right when everybody decides, well, I guess what normally happens isn't going to happen, is usually right when it actually happens and catches them by surprise. So I was talking with a consumer retail researcher earlier this week, Neely Kaminga. And she was saying, you know, I think that from my lens, it looks like the economy is going to kind of muddle through. Mm-hmm. She said the thing that could change that for the worse would be either if the over-leveraged consumer really starts tapping out. She has these different consumer segments, and one of them was over-leveraged consumers, and that was about 20 to 30 million Americans. I mean, it's not a tiny bucket. And then she said either them or over-leveraged corporations start buckling under higher for longer interest rates. To which, when she said that, I said, wow, I can make a pretty good argument that both of those may actually buckle in the not too distant future. Sounds like you think the pressure on at least particularly those two segments is going to continue to increase over the next 6 to 9 months. Do you expect that shoe to drop? Like, would you expect those segments to start struggling pretty, you know, materially in a way that's going to bring economic growth materially down?
I would say, Adam, what I look at right now is corporates more than households. And the reason why I would look at corporates right here is because, look, if you are a US high yield type of company, okay, so a junk rated, below investment grade rated type of company, between 2015 and 2021, you were able to issue bonds, so to fund your business, basically, to issue debt at interest rates around 4 to 5% all in. Okay. So you were paying a risk-free rate and you were paying your credit spread on top, and overall you could borrow at about 4%. Okay. Now, 10-year treasury yield has been north of 4% for several quarters in a row already. Okay, Adam. And on top of it, you need to add credit spreads that are, let's say, in the 300, 350 basis point area. So a high yield borrowing rate in the US is not 4% or 5% anymore, but it's north of 7%, in some cases 8% or double digits even. Okay. So why am I mentioning this? If borrowing rates for corporates are high, but for a short period of time, Adam, and then the Fed can cut rates and then everything goes back, it doesn't really hurt a lot of companies, right? You have to think of the refinancing cycle like a long line over time. Some companies will need to refinance here, some companies there. So if interest rates are high only for this period, it will hurt a very low proportion of the corporate sector, right? Because it's only these companies that are forced to refinance right when interest rates are high. But right, the longer you keep interest rates higher, the more likely it is that you're going to catch a wider share of these companies that are highly levered. They don't really have a great business model. And so they really rely on low interest rates to survive. And so the longer we go with this higher interest rate story, the more company will be forced to refinance at higher interest rates. And what happens then? So if you are a young corporate, probably your business model isn't great. You have a pie of earnings, of cash flows, but it isn't really large, okay? And how did you survive in the past? You had a pie of cash flows, a pie of earnings, and because interest rates were low, only a certain small portion of that were had to dedicate to service your debt, service your debt, right? But now, with the same pie of earnings, pretty much, because your business model hasn't really grown, think about it, you now have to dedicate a lot more of that to paying interest rates on your debt because you're borrowing at 8% right now, right? And so when that happens, well, you can't hire anymore. You can't do any CapEx investments anymore. So basically, you will stop hiring, in other words, or contributing to economic activity. And when that happens, the labor market is going to slow down, the economy is going to slow down, and it starts that cascading effect of finally seeing higher interest rates feed into weaker economic conditions. The process this time is much longer because all these high-yield companies have basically been relatively smart in terming out their debt. So the moment they need to refinance comes much later in time than what we are normally used to in the cycle, but it's about to come. And I think it's something that people don't realize because it just takes time and it's a very slow and boring process. And we live in a world where we want news every day and, you know, we see the stock market going up and then we tend to forget about how macro works and how the lag of tightening cycles really works.
So, if I recall correctly, I think we have something like close to a billion, sorry, close to a trillion in corporate debt maturing this year, re-rating this year, and then more than that the following year, and then pretty substantial amounts still after that. Now, how long rates remain as high as they are, who knows? And the Fed has already kind of, tilted that, hey, we're going to start cutting at some point, right? We'll talk in a moment about how much you think they may be able to cut this year, because I think they've got more headwinds now than they did when Powell made that initial indication. But more and more, I think kind of like the housing market with consumers, the corporate debt market, companies have their strategy so far has just been, cross our fingers and just wait this out. And the Fed's going to ride to our rate. All we got to do is survive until the Fed brings interest rates down, and then we can start, re-rating at less painful yields, or interest rates. And now it's looking like, higher for longer is gonna persist for some period of time here. And even if the Fed gets its three rate cuts this year, if they're paying double digits right now, maybe that comes down into the 9%. I mean, it's still a lot more than they were paying before, like you said, right? So we've got this maturity wall coming that you're worrying about. And from other conversations on this topic with other experts on this channel, I've heard them say, look, CFOs aren't stupid, right? First, they loaded up on the cheap debt and they termed it out, right? So they put themselves in the position that's been good up until now, but they can do math and they can see, you know what? Under the best case scenario, we're going to have to, take on some higher cost debt relatively soon. And I got to start preparing for the impact. So they don't make changes when the debt re-rates. They make changes a quarter or two before, right? That's when they stop the hiring. Maybe that's when they start doing their first rounds of layoffs or whatnot. So as we go into this danger zone that you're talking about, I assume you expect to see in advance more and more of these companies start taking these cost-cutting measures.
Yes, I think you're perfectly right. And let me share a couple of charts with your nice audience here to visualize a bit what we are discussing. So if you look at this chart here, it shows that the bond market is assigning a higher probability to higher for longer. So what I do is I split bond market probabilities into three scenarios: soft landing, recession, and higher for longer. I use the option market, which is embedded in the bond market, and then I can design scenarios and I look at option pricing to understand how much investors are pricing as a probability for each of these scenarios, okay? And if you look at the soft landing, it's by far the dominant outcome, right? Right now, 70% probability is assigned to a soft landing in the United States by the end of the year. So that's by far the dominant probability being priced in. And the recession probability has been, downgraded materially. It's now less than 10%. So people, as we were discussing, have thrown in the towel on a recession. It's not going to happen according to the bond market or to option traders in the bond market. It isn't really going to happen anymore. But I want to draw the attention of people to this red line. This is higher for longer. And higher for longer wasn't really a thing until February, but look at that. Now, higher for longer is almost a 30% probability scenario by the end of the year. And now 30% is not a negligible scenario, Adam, isn't it?
So No.
30% starts to be a meaningful scenario. And that is happening exactly because the Federal Reserve is coming through with this message that it's different. They only have to do a few cuts. Look at the economy. It's handling pretty well. But the reality, as we discussed, is that if you look under the hood, so if you look at the non-farm payrolls in cyclical industries, okay, so we're talking about the industries that are more sensitive to this type of refinancing rates that we are discussing. They're more sensitive to the economic cycle, okay, Adam? They have been hiring on a net basis basically below 1% year-on-year growth in full-time hiring. So these people, these companies here are not really hiring anymore. If you look at the hiring pace of the cyclical industry out there, it's the weakest since 2011. So we are at really pretty weak levels. Actually, when we got recession kind of vibes, for example, in 2007, this line was close to 0%. And it seems like we're getting there, honestly. We're getting there slowly but surely. But the cyclical parts of the economy, the more vulnerable parts of the economy, are taking note of the fact that the bond market is imposing a high interest rate environment for longer. And as you say, CFOs have to program. So if they know they have to refinance at higher rates in 2 quarters, they're not going to hire people. At best, they're going to stop hiring completely. So this line goes to 0% pretty rapidly, which is already a harbinger for a recession in the past. But in the worst case, they probably will be forced to lay off some people.
Which we're seeing now. So layoffs from the start of this year have been at a much higher pace than they were last year. And I don't have the chart handy right now, but a chart I've showed on this program in recent videos is one that shows this growing, the surge in WARN Act notices. So yep. WARN Act is, if you're a big enough company, you have to give your employees advance notice that layoffs are coming, right? And what's interesting is if you look at the initial claims data, still pretty flat, right? But if you look at the WARN notice data, this is from like the over the past like 6 months, it's kind of up and to the right on a 45 degree angle. So, you know, these guys are tipping their hands, right? They're saying, hey, look, you know, we're implementing hiring freezes. Of course, we've seen even in the BLS data that hours work per week or hours work per month are now coming down. So the companies that aren't doing layoffs yet are reducing the hours that their workers are using. So we're seeing what I would consider to be, you know, a lot of early indicators of what you're talking about here. Do you see the same?
Yeah, I think it's the right interpretation also because if you are on severance payment, you do not pop up most likely as an initial claim type of guy. And there are a couple of reasons for that. The first is that the severance payments can last for quite some months. So by the moment you get fired, then you get a severance payment. And then by the moment you file your claim, then you're going to show up in initial claim. So it can Right. take literally quarters in some cases. But also, it's a matter of, you know, basically, the claims or the type of payments you're receiving from the government once you claim basically to be jobless, it's not that great anymore. I mean, in some cases, the gig economy or type of works with, you know, delivery or Uber or other types of work actually pay you better than getting unemployment claims from the government. So there are a couple of reasons why you might want to say, even if people get fired right now, both because of severances and because of alternative type of income streams they can generate in this economy, there might be a reason why the claims aren't popping up just yet. So the situation is, look, I'm not sure why people are surprised that the internals of the job market are weaker. What do you expect? I mean, we have had interest rates over 5% now for 3 quarters in a row. And the Federal Reserve is saying, yes, guys, I mean, we're going to keep that above 4.5 because at best, we're going to deliver 3 cuts this year. So we're going to basically keep them above 4.5% for more than a year. So what would you expect by the end of the year? I would expect a weaker job market. I mean, that's just natural. And if you look at what's happening so far in the labor market, Adam, I think so far, so okay-ish in the grand scheme of things, but the direction of travel is also clear. So the private job creation, 3-month average, that's the blue line, it's 200,000 jobs. And we discussed about the quality of these jobs, the concentration in certain sectors. So if you look at the internals, it's not as good. But from the outside, 200,000 jobs is not a bad number. It is, though, declining pretty rapidly from last year. I mean, the trend is quite clear in that blue line. It's coming down.
Yep.
Wage growth, that's also collapsed. which is another sign, that's the orange line, which is another sign that the job market isn't hot. People are not quitting actively anymore. People are much more conservative. That means they are not getting the wage gains they would get in a hot labor market. In a
right,
hot labor market,
the power
guys,
structure is shifting back to the employer. Yeah.
Correct. In a hot labor market, you want a hot labor market? Look at late 2021 or early 2022, before the Fed hiked. Labor demand was very strong. We were adding 600,000 net jobs a month in the private sector. That's a huge amount. And wage growth was over 6%. That's a hot labor market, okay? And it makes sense. We were restarting the economies after the pandemic, huge fiscal stimulus flowing through the economy. We don't have anything of that sort right now. So obviously, you're going to have the labor market weaken. And the cherry on the cake is the U6 broad unemployment rate. That's the red line.
That's very important. I agree.
Yeah. So we can talk about what that is. It shows that, you know, it's basically bottomed very clearly at early 2023. And since then, it's been rising pretty steadily, and it's now 7.3%. And I think this broad unemployment rate is quite important because it captures a broader definition of what does it mean to be unemployed. Okay, so the U3 unemployment rate effectively looks at unemployed people in the labor force. Okay, but the U6, the broader definition of unemployment rate, also looks at two more categories. It looks at people that are unemployed. It looks at people that are marginally attached to the labor force, which means they're not really trying hard to look for a job anymore. Mm-hmm. They've given up. And it looks at part-time for economic reasons. So those are people that are basically forced to work part-time. And they would work full-time if they could, but they are forced to work part-time. Okay, because economic conditions aren't that strong and labor demand is not that strong. And that underemployment rate, so the broader definition of unemployment rate, U6, has been picking up pretty materially over the last two quarters. And I think also here, the direction of travel is pretty clear. The job market internals are weakening. But again, my question is, what would you expect
yeah.
to be otherwise? I mean, it's reasonable that it weakens. We're just discussing here, Adam, how fast does it weaken? Where is the landing point? Can the Fed achieve a GDP growth of like 1.5%? Or is it going to get worse? When and why? But the fact that the trend is negative, I think it's undeniable.
So I'm going to try to pull up a chart here while we're talking.
Sure.
But when you look at past recessions, the chart I'm going to try to find shows that the unemployment rate generally tends to be fine, and then it starts spiking up. So as we sort of fall into recession, it's a transition that happens extremely quickly.
Yes.
So the fact that U6 is beginning to rise here, does that tend to be a leading indicator for U3?
Yeah, U6 is generally, being a broader definition, I think it works better because it captures also these parts of unemployment that aren't measured into U3. And if somebody becomes marginally attached to the labor force or it's forced to work part-time, even if she or he doesn't want, I think those are clear signs that the labor market is slowing. The other thing that I want to show, maybe I can show a chart while you look for yours, that looks at the cycle, let's say. So how long does it take for the job market to weaken once the Federal Reserve raises interest rates? Let's take a look at that. So the chart I'm sharing here looks at the inversion time in 2 to 10 year yield curve. So when the 2 to 10 year yield curve inverts, and then it looks at the trend in US private job creation thereafter. So then it looks at all cases of recession we've had since the 80s, okay? So the 80s, mid 80s, late 80s, 2000, 2008, and pretty much today. And the blue line that you see on the chart here is the trend in private job creation. Okay, so how many jobs are we creating in the private sector in the US? Okay. And the counter that you see here, the zero, is when the yield curve inverts for the first time meaningfully. Okay. So the counter is the number of months it takes for the blue line to drop until you are in a recession. And the recession is the red shaded area. Okay. So now take a look. Every time the cycle is always the same, Adam. The yield curve inverts, time zero. Then you have a bunch of months when private job creation deteriorates, generally from 300,000 to 400,000 all the way to zero, pretty much zero jobs being created on a monthly basis. At that point, you know, that you're about to go into a recession. The curve disinverts, by the way, right before or right into a recession. Okay, that's another clear signal. When the curve has been inverted and then it disinverts when the job market is weakening, you're basically there. Now, if you look at what has happened over the last five recessions, the pattern has pretty much been the same. So you have had this inversion of the curve, weakening of private sector job creation, and then a recession, which pretty much tended to happen in line with the disinversion. Disinversion can happen a bit before, a bit later, but the pattern seems to be clear. And now you look at the last two recessions, and there the pattern was pretty much the same. So inversion, weakening in the job market, disinversion, recession. Same in 2007. But look at the number of months that it took in 2007. 2007, it took 27 months between the first significant yield curve inversion and a deterioration in the labor market, which was consistent with the recession. Okay, 27 months. Now we're at month number 22. 23 as we speak, we're entering 23. But the trend looks pretty much the same. The only difference is that we start from a much higher level, 600,000 jobs. That's our starting level when the curve inverted. But we are walking towards that type of pattern where the next thing you would expect is a rapid sequence of disinversion of the yield curve and the job market going towards this 0-50,000 jobs added per month, which generally precedes a weak labor market in line with the recession.
Got it. Those are fascinating charts, super useful. And yeah, I mean, it explains why it's maybe taking longer than people expected this time, because we started at the top of a much higher mountain that we had to descend.
Yeah.
But you know, we're not that far away now. So yeah, I mean, your sort of expectation of, hey, in 6 to 9 months, we might really start to see some fallout, I think that seems to be perfectly believable given that last chart.
And the other thing is, we're talking about the US, but to be frank, if you ask me where a potential macro volatility event might arise, I think you're going to see it sooner elsewhere than in the US, Adam, because you know other global economies have tried to follow the Fed on their hiking cycle one-on-one, but they are not equipped nearly as well as the US is to handle these higher interest rates. I mean, the ECB, the European Central Bank, didn't cut interest rates at the last meeting. They're basically looking at the Fed saying, hey, give me your green light before I can start cutting as well. But GDP growth in Europe is 0%. And in Canada, it's pretty weak. If you adjust for population growth, GDP growth in Canada is very disappointing. In Australia, you have a weak economy. In New Zealand, you have a weak economy. Shall we talk about China? Shall we open that Pandora box? I mean, I think an accident might happen actually earlier somewhere else than it is in the US. The US is amongst the cleanest dirty sheets, let's say, out there.
Right. In fact, we would expect the weaker players to fall before the US does.
Yeah, I would agree there. And honestly, this euphoria, animal spirits running loose, they run loose as well in 2007 with interest rates at 5% and late in the cycle. They run loose as well in 2000, early 2000, with interest rates at 5% and late in the cycle. So I think people should keep their eyes open, follow the macro playbook, follow the lags, look at the internals, do the work, and don't get, you know, fooled into this crazy animal spirit market we're looking at today.
All right, so you're taking exactly where I want to take it. I just want to share my screen real quickly just to show folks the chart we talked about, and then we're going to go straight into animal spirits. So if you see here, this is the U3 unemployment rate. And you'll see right before every recession, it's fine, 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 fine. Then pow, it starts popping up every single time, right? So, you know, we're already seeing U3 begin to come up, right? I forgot to mention that in this latest blowout jobs report, the unemployment rate did still manage to jump from 3.7 to 3.9. So we're very close to a four handle on unemployment. And, you know, again, I don't think anybody believes these numbers coming out of the BLS anymore for a whole variety of reasons. But certainly a very visible one is no matter what they tell you it is, the next month they're going to come back and tell you, oh, you know what, we actually just revised it down by a substantial amount. So we had a massive blowout jobs report in January. That just got reduced by over 35% downwards, right, this month. So turning it from a massive beat to really just more of an average number.
Yeah.
So, all right. So in the context of this sort of lag of the what we see, believe to see are early signs that the lag effect actually hasn't been repealed and is beginning to enforce itself. And I'm hammering on this because I've talked about the lag effect for so often that, you know, I think a lot of people understandably might have said, hey, Adam, you've been beating this drum forever and it just hasn't happened. Drop it, dude. I think both you and I are saying now, like, we're beginning to see signs that it's arriving here. Can't take the victory lap yet, but yeah, things are beginning to look better. But markets don't care, right? Markets aren't caring about anything that we're talking about, right? So, you know, stocks hitting new highs, bonds doing pretty well, speculation completely roared back. We've got it in, you know, Nvidia trading at 40 times sales. We've got meme stocks showing life again. We've got Bitcoin at all-time highs. So you mentioned here that this actually is pretty consistent with history, that the markets tended to, the animal spirits kind of go wild right before we fall into these recessions. Darius Dale, who's been on this program several times, we've talked about how the party gets its wildest right before the cops show up, right? So like, what probability do you think that that's what we're seeing right now? That this is the last hurrah before, you know, the cops show up and spoil everybody's fun?
I think there is actually even a connection between the last hurrah and the cops showing up, because if it's true that the Federal Reserve doesn't target Bitcoin prices, there is a potential nexus there, because if animal spirits might even restart somewhere like in the housing market or in the neighborhood of the housing market, then the Federal Reserve starts to get pretty scared, right? Because they haven't won their battle on inflation. People are bidding any asset they can find. What if they start bidding house prices as well? I mean, it's not my base case, but in that case, they would be pretty much forced to come in and, you know, pull the brakes again. Yep. But the point here is, guys, investors aren't thinking macro here. So what's happening is you're having NFTs of penguins and monkeys being purchased for over $500,000. I'm serious. That's happening right now as we speak.
Are we back to that again?
Yeah, we are. Well, you can check, actually, there is public data. Over $500,000 has been spent over the last few weeks to buy an NFT of a monkey and a penguin. So, you know, that's where we are, Adam. Not only that, we are seeing coins named after Joe Biden or whatever the misspelling is of the coin going up 8,000% in a week. Yesterday, I think there was a coin on Elizabeth Warren with a misspelling going up 9,000% in a day. So guys, that's what we're talking about here, okay? It's pure animal spirits. And if you want to move to conventional assets that incarnate a bit more animal spirits, then you can have a look at Bitcoin or gold. Now, let me stop you for a second before people eat me alive. Gold specifically is not only an interpretation of animal spirits, but it also has strong monetary features. That's why gold belongs in a macro portfolio. For Bitcoin, it's more of a new version, a more experimental version, let's say, of that potential monetary features. But you also have to recognize that when risk-free rates are at 5.25%, Adam, 4 quarters, and the Fed is telling you they're going to be reasonably around 5% for a while, you do have a risk-free alternative that yields pretty well. If, despite that, you're going to buy assets that do not produce any cash flows, like gold or Bitcoin right now, then probably you're doing that because of animal spirits, to participate in the momentum trade, to feel richer than your neighbor. There's a thing that I call the neighbor tracking error, and it's a very popular concept. So it goes like that. You know, tracking error is basically that difference in performance you might have against the benchmark, right? But what if we say the tracking error against the neighbor? What if the neighbor has Nvidia and Supermicro computers, and he has Bitcoin and maybe one of these Carvana stocks, which is basically bankrupt, has gone up 50% over the last few weeks? What if he has it and you don't? If you don't have it, then you're experiencing the neighbor tracking error. You're watching him become richer, basically, on paper, that is. You're watching him becoming richer, and you have this chasing attitude, this FOMO thing, right? You have to run into the momentum trade as well. And it doesn't matter whether risk-free rates are 5, 4, 3, 1, 6%. In 2007 and in 2000, the same type of FOMO animal spirits were there. Risk-free rates were over 5%. Both in 2007 and in 2000. So you did have an alternative. And nevertheless, people chased assets with no cash flows. This tells you they're not thinking about macro. It's pure animal spirits running loose.
All right. So, well, let me ask this. So Bitcoin, then I'm assuming you think its run-up is mostly due to speculative fervor as opposed to store value, right? With gold, and you're not... You might be the second person in 2 days to make the same comment, but it sounds like you think gold price right now is being driven more by speculation than by a safety trade.
So I need to make sure that people understand there are two things going on here. Okay, one thing is the animal spirits that are running loose that put people to bid any assets out there right now, pretty much, including assets with no cash flows like gold or Bitcoin, despite having a risk free rate at 5.25%. So also gold and Bitcoin have been caught basically into the animal spirits type of behavior. But we can also apply a valuation framework to these assets that is more of a long-term valuation framework. Basically, Adam, I'm trying to answer the question, how much should Bitcoin be worth? Right. How much should gold be worth? Okay, those are the questions I'm trying to answer. And that's not a thing that has to do with today, animal spirits, but I think it's a useful framework that people can use to get an idea of where are the valuations and what is the right price for gold. And if Bitcoin might play a similar role of gold in the future as a potential alternative to fiat money, maybe a digital gold, let's say, can I use the same valuation framework to attach a price to Bitcoin? And the answer is, let's take a look together. So let me share a chart with you, starting from gold, okay? And why do I start from gold is because gold has actually served the purpose of an alternative to the fiat system for centuries, and has done so basically until the 1970s, until the gold peg was basically released. And look, if you want to value an asset like gold from a monetary standpoint, Adam, what would you do? What I did is I looked at the market capitalization of gold. So I looked at all the gold that is on Earth right now, basically physical amount of gold on Earth times the price of gold. Okay, that gives me the market capitalization of the gold market, which is about, I think something about $7 trillion, okay, roughly. Mm-hmm. Now, what does it mean, 7 trillion? Is that a lot? Is that too little? If gold is an alternative that can coexist or even replace the current fiat system, then you want to measure the market cap of gold in percentage to the amount of spendable fiat money in our system today. So you want to basically compare the two measures, right? One is an alternative or a complement to the other, fiat and gold. So now you measured what is the market cap of gold. But what is the market cap of fiat money? In other words, how much fiat money is out there? Spendable real economy money. So that's what I did. I took the five largest economies in the world as a proxy for the globe, let's say, and I looked at how much fiat money, spendable fiat money, the money that we use, Adam, okay? How much is it out there in China, US, Europe, UK, and Japan? And the answer is that the market cap of gold today represents roughly 20% of the total fiat in existence in the five largest countries in the world. Why do I think this is an interesting model to look at? If you look at the last 10 years, this has been a very, very nice model to try and derive where the price of gold should be. And the answer is it should be at about 20% of the stock of fiat money. The trick is that the stock of fiat money grows over time, Adam. And so that explains why if you want to keep this ratio at 20% over time, also the price of gold needs to go up.
Has to go up, yeah.
All right. So right now, it says 20%. Can it get more expensive? Yes. In 2020, 2021, it got to 22%, the same in 2013. So gold could get even more expensive than this. Sure. And I like gold. I've said it a few quarters ago as well. And I think it could go to 2,500. Yes, it can go there. Now you have a framework to try and understand how gold is valued. And the most important takeaway, Adam, is the denominator, the fiat money in the five largest economies in the world. Guys, I can assure you that it will keep growing over time because this is how the system is built. The system, the fiat system is built to grow the amount of fiat currency in the world, right? And so if gold has to preserve 20% of a growing denominator as its market cap, that means the price of gold has to go up over time as well. Now let's apply the same framework to Bitcoin. Okay, so what I did is I took Bitcoin, or in general, the crypto market cap, okay, which is roughly about 2 trillion as we speak. Okay, so 2 trillion represents about 4%, let's say, of the stock of fiat money in the five largest economies in the world. And now I can hear already a few people say, whoa, 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 that means that Bitcoin has to go 5x in price, right? To reach the same level in this chart on this axis of of gold, from 4%, we need to go to 20%. So then Bitcoin has to go 5x. So that means it needs to be worth $350,000.
Yep.
And here I'm going to be saying, wait a second, calm down. Few reasons there. First of all, this guy, gold, has proven his role as an alternative to the fiat system for centuries. And Bitcoin is a new kid in town, right? So you need to apply some slack here, I would say, in this valuation. But even if you say, hey, over time, Adam, I would assume Bitcoin can cover half the ground of gold, let's say. So it can go to 10% under this valuation framework. In principle, there is room for Bitcoin prices to grow over time, both because this percentage can go up and both because, as always, the denominator goes up. The amount of fiat in the system goes up, and that pushes mechanically the price of Bitcoin higher over time as well, like it pushes the price of gold higher over time as well.
All right, fascinating. So you're basically saying, look, there are fundamental reasons, obviously, just as the pool of money around the world grows, that these asset prices should go up. But I think earlier too, you were saying, look, animal spirits are playing a big role in the here and now.
Yes.
How do you think about parsing out sort of the fundamental value versus just the craziness of the moment?
It depends whether you're a trader or an investor. And I would say if you're an investor, you have already built a macro portfolio that has these assets as part of that portfolio to basically serve the monetary role you want them to serve if you need that hedge. Okay, so then you have some gold, you maybe have some Bitcoin in the right proportion in your portfolio, Adam, and now you're reaping the benefits of it. Now, interestingly, you're not reaping the benefits because the monetary system is changing right now. You're reaping the benefits for other reasons, but having these assets in your portfolio can be an added value to your performance adjusted for risk over time. They serve this monetary feature, this monetary hedge feature into your portfolio. If you're a more short-term investor, yeah, then I'm sorry to break the news to you that Bitcoin isn't going up because the monetary system is falling apart. Bitcoin is going up because it is an asset that also incarnates animal spirits. And that's why it's going up pretty rapidly, pretty vertically. And so now you need to ask yourself, for how long can these animal spirits go on? And it basically becomes a momentum trade. You need to be a trend trader, basically. You look at these things, the lines are going up. If you overlay the chart on Nvidia and Cisco, so Nvidia today and Cisco in the 2000s, they look one-on-one, right? So then that's a bit of a scary proposition because you say, well, some of these technical indicators are getting overstretched. Should I jump on the boat or should I be more conservative? But that's a discussion for traders. I mean, you're talking about momentum traders here. And I'm not a momentum trader. I'm a macro investor. So I just want to make sure that people understand why the prices of gold and Bitcoin are going up. It doesn't have to do with anything monetary framework related right now, although you can apply a model, as we saw, to discount them. It has to do with animal spirits. So then be the judge of whether you want to pursue these animal spirits and try to close the tracking error with your neighbor or your friend that has Bitcoin and you don't, maybe, or you want to behave like a rational investor and look at portfolios from a macro perspective. I would suggest option number two.
I was just going to say that. All right. Well, look, this is providing great segue, which we'll make in a moment to your new macro fund, and also just the question I normally ask you, which is, hey, Alf, how are you allocating given the current environment that you see?
Yeah.
Real quick, if we can we just go to bonds for a moment,
sure,
which are
sure.
Really kind of your, you know, that's the bullseye of your expertise. We haven't really even talked about that much. Stocks are raging right now. And we gave nod to kind of how speculative the price action is there. I don't think you would necessarily say that bonds are at a speculative, you know, high right now, but what do you see in the bond market?
So what I see is the front end of the bond market, which is basically forced to align with the Federal Reserve, Adam, because the Federal Reserve effectively can influence 2-year bond yields very closely. 2-year bond yields can be thought of, Adam, as the reflection of what the Federal Reserve will be doing over the next 2 years. Okay, so if the Federal Reserve says, hey guys, I'm not going to cut rates, I'm very stubborn, then 2-year yields are somehow pinned basically to a high level, okay, because they have to reflect what the Fed will be doing soon. So you see that happening, right? So 2-year interest rates have been basically over 4.5% for a long period of time right now. So a few cuts are priced in, but not many. And it's hard for the bond market to fight the Fed on the front end unless something is breaking. Mm-hmm. So until something breaks, 2-year interest rates will be pinned around 4.5%, 4.75%. But then you look at the bottom end of the curve, and that's starting to send some different signals, right? It's saying, well, okay, dudes at the Federal Reserve, if you don't see the internals weakening in the job market, if you don't see the fact that core inflation is already annualizing basically at 2% and the direction seems clear, and you want to be stubborn at the front end, then what I'm going to do is I'm going to place some of that weakness in growth and inflation in the back end of the curve. So then the curve has been flattening, again, inverting even more to the surprise of many. Because we entered the year and everybody wanted the curve to steepen. You know, the curve had to steepen to reflect strong fundamentals, strong economic growth, a proactive Federal Reserve cutting interest rates. And none of this is happening. The opposite is happening. The Fed is saying, nana, I'm not going to cut rates. I even expect them now to say at the March meeting, oh, we are thinking about a higher neutral rate. Yeah, we think that the economy can handle higher interest rates structurally. You know, they're going into that direction, I think, as communication. And then the bond market is saying, yeah, sure. So 2-year rates, you are in control, but the 10-year and the 30-year rates, I am more in control. So they are inverting the curve, pushing that potential weakness down the road, basically into 5, 10, and 30-year bonds. And that's been happening. And, you know, I think how this is going to solve itself is when the Federal Reserve has been stubborn for long enough that it has managed to create some damage, or possibly that the damage has happened somewhere else in the world in a systemically important market. Can it be China? It's already happening. Can it be Europe? Can it be Australia? Can it be Canada? Can it be New Zealand? I'm mentioning all these economies because they're structurally more fragile than the United States, but they've raised interest rates following the Fed almost one-on-one. So the pressure they're facing is much more intense. And when you think China, it's a closed economy when it comes to capital flows. I mean, there are capital controls in China. So if something blows up there, it is hard to for that to directly affect global markets. But what it can do is it can weaken trade flows. Mm-hmm. If China is weakening, China isn't buying stuff from Brazil. China isn't investing in Australia. China isn't investing in Canada. And that lack of flows can deteriorate already fragile situations that are there, for example, in Australia and Canada or in some emerging markets. So I think that this is how it's going to solve. Either outside the US, probably more likely, or in the US, the Federal Reserve is going to be stubborn for so long that it ultimately breaks something. And then finally, the curve can steepen, but it steepens for the wrong reasons. It steepens, as we have seen before, just heading into a recession.
Got it. And so it seems like you think this inversion will happen the way that it typically does, which is the front end will come down,
yeah,
versus the bearish steepening of the long end going up.
That's correct. And because I think we have already tried the bearish steepening last year. I think I was on the program explaining how that works, that bearish, yeah, steepening move. And I think we have tried that and we have utterly failed because we have bear steepened. And then after that, we have had a big, big rally in the bond market, if you remember, in November and December after that bear steepening. So I think now the final steepening is going to be the typical bull steepening preceding a recession. And that makes me, when it comes to asset allocation, that makes me in general, and I've been and I continue to be positive on gold, because when you have this type of bull steepening events preceding a recession, what happens, Adam, is that 2-year interest rates drop very rapidly. So the Federal Reserve has to change their tune very quickly towards a dovish stance. So all of a sudden, risk-free rates aren't high anymore. They start to become much lower. And if they become lower, then people have an alternative. And the alternative is gold. At that point, it provides you with safety and people want that. So I think 2 to 5 year bonds and gold are a good asset to have in your portfolio right now. And the other thing, if you really have to have an equity exposure, defensive equities have been killed. So anything that is like consumer staples, utilities, all these sectors that are less sensitive to the economic cycle, they've been left behind. So if you want to have equity exposure, there are decent companies, anti-cyclical, more defensive. You can have those. 2 to 5 year bonds, I think, are great. Gold is a good asset to have in your portfolio. And the dollar, interestingly, it's something that people always say, Alf, if the Fed is going to cut rates because of a recession, then the dollar has to go down. I'm going to ask you to have a look at the conditions that are happening, because if recessionary conditions are emerging because something is going wrong elsewhere in the world, then I'm not sure that the dollar goes down in that case. The dollar can be seen as a safe haven currency, as a deleveraging type of currency where everybody wants the safety of the dollar in that case.
Yeah, it's the Brent, and also just the Brent Johnson as the rest of the world gets in trouble, and euro dollar loans start getting compromised. It increases the demand for dollars to have to repay those. So,
Wow, that's the quickest, most effective milkshake explanation I've ever heard, Adam. Great.
I think I've been in interviews with Brent like 4 times already since the start of 2024. He's totally sick of seeing me. So great list of things to look at there. Let me just ask, when you say 2 to 5 year bonds are good, and by bonds, I'm assuming you're really talking about US Treasuries.
Yes.
So 2 to 5, because one, obviously it's very safe. Two, if you buy them now, you're locking in a pretty good yield that will be
Correct.
relatively much better than the yield will be if the Fed starts having to cut aggressively like you think it will. So you're going to get that good, nice, tasty yield with safety for the next 2 to 5 years. Plus, you're going to get some appreciation in those bonds as well, right? So it seems like on a risk-reward basis, pretty good. You're nodding as I'm saying this.
Yes, that's exactly it. And it's also, those are very liquid instruments, which means that if you get it right in terms of the timing of a potential deterioration of global economies, then you have not only locked in good yields, but also you'll get the price appreciation and you'll get a very liquid instrument which you can sell and monetize, Adam, at the moment when other assets are trading at a discount. So when equities have gone down to reasonable prices and you're sitting on treasuries that are making money, they're very liquid, you can sell them. And as Warren Buffett says, you should buy when other people are very fearful, not when they're greedy. And today they're very, very greedy. So I would suggest that you take the other side of the Buffett advice, which is be careful when people are greedy and instead be aggressive when people are fearful. One way to be aggressive is when you have had instruments in your portfolio that are safe, liquid, and have made money and that you can monetize to move into more risky assets at the right price.
Makes total sense. And I'm just going to pull up this chart. I pulled it up prematurely, but this is a chart of the Fed funds rate over the past couple of decades. And you can see how going into recessions, it is, usually the Fed realizes we stayed too high for too long, and then it panic cuts all the way down. And so it sounds like when we talk about, you're thinking that history is probably more likely to repeat here. That's exactly what we're going to see here, which of course makes the 2 to 5 year US Treasury much more attractive.
The funny stuff is that generally, when you proceed recessions, markets are instead pricing a very shallow and predictable cutting cycle that never materializes. The cutting cycle is generally rushed into and very aggressive. So, for instance, in 2000, the Federal Reserve, as you can see in the chart, cut from 6.25% to below 2% in a year. So they cut 400 basis points in a year. Okay. Right now, the market is pricing 75 basis point of cuts in a year, not 400, 75 basis point of cuts.
All right. So again, just to beat the horse dead, you're expecting more something like this to happen at some point, correct?
Yeah, I would say that the risk reward right now in positioning portfolios, because the recession probability is so low right now, you're getting opportunities to basically position your portfolio more defensively at very low prices. So you can get that done basically without having to leave on the table a lot of premium. And you should, I think, people should look into that because it's not been a very successful type of positioning over the last year. In other words, you've still made some money, but your neighbor has become way richer than you because he has had Nvidia and Bitcoin, et cetera, and you didn't. And right now he's parting and the party is getting very, very loud, very loud. And when it gets very loud, this late in the cycle, history says it's a better idea to leave the party a bit early, huh? And go home safe, you know, have somebody else, a designated driver, go home safe in your 2 to 5 year treasuries and sit it out. I think that's something people should consider.
All right. Well, my friend, we're getting near the end here. And thank you for sharing, you know, what you think are kind of good assets to hold in the current here and now, given this condition. But you also are looking to the future, which is, hey, I'm not just trying to navigate the next couple months. I'm trying to put together a fund that's going to help people navigate the next couple of decades. Tell us about that.
So, Adam, I'm launching my macro fund. And the reason why I'm doing that is because I think macro volatility will dominate the next decade. The use of fiscal deficits, the combination of fiscal and monetary, demographics are completely different in China and elsewhere in the world than they were in the past 10 to 20 years. In other words, inflation and growth will be much more volatile, and a 60-40 portfolio or other standard portfolios alone are not optimal to face such a volatile market environment. So a macro fund is a very good complement to standard portfolios because it's able, being nimble, to look at opportunities around the world and try to monetize these opportunities. So I think the time is ripe to launch a macro fund. I was about to say relaunch because I already managed money in my life for ING, a $20 billion portfolio. I left that job in 2021 when the market was pretty much boring and dead, especially in interest rates and in FX, nothing was going on. But right now, instead, a lot is going on, and I think it will be going on even further over the next 5 to 10 years. And to protect people from this volatility and make sure they can harvest these opportunities, I think launching a macro fund right now makes a lot of sense.
All right. Well, if folks want to learn more about it, where can they go?
So the very simple thing to do is just to send me an email. You can send an email to fund@themacrocompass.com. So fund@themacrocompass.com. And, you know, you can simply ask for more information. And what I will do is I will send you the fund memo. Fund memo is a simple document that explains the strategy, target risk, target return, instruments we're going to be looking into, and the various details of the fund, in other words. And if you're interested in looking into that and discussing a potential allocation, you just send an email, you receive the information, and you can have a chat with me about the fund.
Okay, great. Alf, when I edit this, I will put up that email address right on the screen. Sure. Folks will also put it in the link in the description below. Is there any particular investor that this fund is the right fit for? And I guess, yeah, especially, do people need to be like an accredited investor, or is this for everybody?
No. So how it works is that I'm now in the early investor window. So that means that I'm raising early interest, potential early interest for the fund. The benefit of being an early investor is that you get preferential conditions locked in forever. So if you want to be part of this potential preferential window, you should try to hurry up because the window is going to close at some point. But to be part of this early window, your minimum investment should be $250,000. So less than that cannot be accommodated into this early window share class, basically. And it's also due to regulatory reasons. But in other, to make it very simple, if you want to try and lock in these early benefits, you need to be investing at least $250,000. Later on, there will also be probably lower allocations or share classes accommodating for a bit of a lower entry level. But right now, it's $250,000.
All right. I'm glad we clarified that. And you know, I just had to go get a securities license not that long ago, and I'm very fresh with all the regulations and restrictions that you're having to navigate putting this fund together right there. So I know a lot of these decisions are not yours. It's just the way that the regulators force you to do it. All right. Well, look, Alf, as always, phenomenal conversation. I could continue discussing all this with you for hours more, but I see it's already gotten dark in the Netherlands where you are while we've been talking. I got to let you go have dinner with your wife. Real quick, as we wrap up here, I've got a little bit of housekeeping, just updates for folks. But then I want to ask you one last question if we can. So I'll give you a minute to think about it while I do the housekeeping. And that question is going to be, we've been talking all about money, and financial topics so far. I want to hear, one non-money related investment that you think folks should consider integrating into their lives. Right before I ask you that, folks, if you'd like to have Alf come back on the program again in the not too distant future, especially when he starts seeing some indicators on his screen more vividly that the lag effects that we talked about here may indeed be expressing itself and we might be getting into some tipping points, either market valuation wise or economy wise, Please let them know you'd like them to come back on the program for that by hitting the like button and then clicking on the red subscribe button below, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. I can't believe I didn't mention this right at the opening of this discussion, but the Thoughtful Money Spring Conference is now less than 1 week away. It is this coming Saturday. If you have not registered for it yet, drop everything you're doing. Go do so now. Go to thoughtfulmoney.com/conference. Lock in your tickets. It's going to be a phenomenal event. I won't go through the litany of amazing speakers that we have for it. It's going to be like 8 or 9 hours worth, but you can get them at the link that I just mentioned. And just a reminder, if you can't watch live or you can't watch the whole day live, don't worry, because replay videos of the entire event, all the presentations, all the live Q&A are going to be sent to everybody within 24 hours of its conclusion. And just a reminder too, in addition to those of you who might be really interested in considering ALF's fund, for the rest of your capital, potentially very challenging environment heading up here that ALF did a phenomenal job of outlining here for us. Most regular people, I think, feel challenged navigating that on their own. They don't feel like they've got the experience, the expertise, or just the bandwidth in their life to do it all themselves. So for the vast majority of people watching this channel, that's why I recommend so strongly that you work under the guidance of a good professional financial advisor. If you've got a good one who takes into account all the macro issues that ALF and I have been talking about here, great, stick with them. They are worth their weight in gold. And for all the right reasons that ALF mentioned, that gold value is probably going to appreciate going forward, and so will the value of your good advisor in this type of environment. But there are very few people that hit that set of qualifications. But if you got one, stick with them. If you don't, but would like, if you don't, or you'd like a second opinion from one who does, then consider scheduling a free consultation with one of the financial advisors that you see on this channel with me week after week. To do that, just go to thoughtfulmoney.com, fill out the very short form there. These consultations are personalized to you. They don't cost you anything. There's no commitment to work with these guys. It's just a free public service they offer to try to help as many people as possible, position as prudently as possible in advance of what might be coming. Alf, thanks for your patience. Now we're here at that final question. What is one non-money related investment that you would encourage folks to consider integrating into their lives?
Communication skills. So if I could walk back and go to 10 years ago and reassign my time and efforts, I would spend even more time than I did on my communication skills. And that has to do with verbal communication, presentation skills, anything that has to do with being able to communicate more effectively. It's a superpower, literally, because there are plenty of smart people listening to this interview and around the world. But the combination of being smart and technically good, but also being able to convey your message in a powerful way, it's very rare. And the communication skill coupled with good technical skills will supercharge your ability to be successful in whatever you do, being an employee at a good company and, just going through your career or being an entrepreneur. So communication skills is the best investment, non-money related, that comes to mind.
So I completely agree with that. I think that's such a great one. Communication skills are really the transfer mechanism between value creation and actual impact, right? There's an old saying in business, business is 20% getting a great product and then 80% getting your product in the hands of your target audience, right? And I think that's the same true on the individual level, right? If you have a skill set, but you don't know how to communicate to a potential client or partner what you're able to do with that skill set, they're not going to know. They're not going to be interested, right? It, as you said, it is like a superpower. And sadly, there are people who are great at communicating who actually maybe not be great value creators, but they put so much sizzle on the steak that they succeed a lot because they convince people.
That's true. That's true. So I think Jeff Bezos, he's a great communicator, for example. Most of the success of Amazon, I think, is built around his ability to communicate. Think about Steve Jobs as well. Excellent communicators. There are plenty of books that one can read, especially they detail the ability of these great communicators. And so they studied their personal experience. And, it's definitely worth an investment thinking about your own communication skills and working on them.
Is there a particular book that you'd want to put on people's radar?
I was trying to remember the title. I'm terrible at it. So next time I'm on the show, I'll make sure that I remember the title. But there is one on Jeff Bezos in particular. So if you just type Jeff Bezos Communication Skills book, you'll probably find it. That I read a few months ago. And of course, I don't remember the title. I'm terrible at titles. I'm sorry.
No worries. Well, folks, you can go to Google and find it. But anyways, Alf, thank you so much. And clearly from this discussion, folks can really tell that you have honed your communication skills to a very sharp point. Really love having these conversations with you. Anytime you want to come back on the channel, the floor is available to you. But can't thank you enough. And everybody else, thanks so much for watching.